Thank you so much for that very kind introduction, John. And it's great to come down to the Berkman Center and put so many names to faces of people that I've known virtually but have never actually met in person. It's very exciting for me. So many people that I've known and admired personally and professionally for many years. And it's long overdue, I think, to come down here. So I'm glad to come, even if it's just a short visit today. What I wanted to talk about today was the Siphon Project, which is, as John mentioned, one of the main projects that we've been working on at the Citizen Lab. We released Siphon December 1st, 2006. It's a software tool that we developed to help people get around censorship. And so in my talk today, what I want to do is explain a bit about the context behind Siphon, why we developed this piece of software at the Citizen Lab, go through what Siphon actually does and how it works, for those of you who haven't had a chance to try it out yet, and then talk about some of the plans we have for Siphon and some of the dilemmas that we face currently to sustain it. And I think the problems that are particular to Siphon are actually generalizable to the human rights open source software community as a whole. And I know a lot of people in this room think long and hard about those problems. And so we're in the middle of facing them, and this is an opportunity for me to meet among good friends and colleagues and kind of seek advice and feedback as to where we're going to go from here.
And so, you're okay that this is being webcast to the world, that sort of thing?
The world is full of friends and colleagues.
Awesome. All right. That's the real open source spirit, right?
You're talking to someone, after all, who for many years, I don't any longer, I used to have a webcam in my office 24 hours
a day.
Hey,
Jonathan, too. Yeah.
And Jonathan, too, yeah. So I stopped it for some reason. Anyway, let
we
me
won't
begin.
Ask.
No particular issue. Well, let me begin by just setting the context for how Siphon emerged. And a lot of this is really the story of the OpenNet initiative. And I actually brought, earlier today, I gave a talk and I brought some of our posters that we as the OpenNet initiative developed. For those of you who, I think what it looks like three left maybe, you're welcome to take them.
Wow.
If you leave me your card, I can send you more. This is an overview of the research that the OpenNet initiative has done over the last year. And it gives a nice snapshot of all of our findings. And I guess the bottom line is that it's a kind of troubling story, I would say. There used to be this conventional wisdom about the internet, that it was an open network of networks and a global commons of information, that people could access information freely and communicate to a global audience. Whether or not that was true in the past, I'm of the view increasingly that it's no longer true, that the internet is being carved up, colonized, and militarized. And I think it's very much a crisis for those of us who support human rights online. And that indeed is the motivation for all of the research that we do at the Citizen Lab. I think it's being carved up, colonized, and militarized through censorship practices, through surveillance, and through what I would characterize as an arms race in cyberspace that's emerging. Some of this will be well known to people in the audience here today. As John said, I'm one of the principal investigators of the OpenNet initiative. And there, our main finding has really been that the scope and the scale and sophistication of internet censorship practices have grown tremendously over the last 4 years since we started the project. When we set out in 2002 or 2003, we were looking at maybe two, three countries that were known to engage in internet content filtering. In the last round of our research, we tested in close to 40 countries worldwide. So the problem's growing. The type of content that is being targeted for filtering is growing as well. When we started out, countries certainly justified their filtering practices in terms of targeting pornography or maybe sites related to national security concerns. Now we see states filtering access to political opposition movements, to human rights information, to encyclopedias like Wikipedia, to news sources. The way in which they do this also is very troubling. There are some countries that if you try to access information, you may get a block page that tells you you're trying to access forbidden content. But the vast majority of countries don't do that. They're not open about the fact that they engage in internet filtering. You may get a network error when you try to access a site. And this, to me, is really a nefarious set of practices, because you don't know what is actually being denied to you when you encounter that sort of problem, unless you can do some comparison like the Open Net Initiative does. Part of the reason that it's growing in scope, scale, and sophistication worldwide is because of the new market that has emerged for companies that provide filtering software and expertise in this area. We used to think of the best and brightest in Silicon Valley as being associated with wiring the world and connecting people worldwide, and this is certainly how they advertise themselves. But increasingly we're finding there is this market for doing the exact opposite, to help enclose the internet, to carve it up and limit people's access to information and freedom of speech. And I would say that I very much applaud the efforts that have been done by my colleagues to help some of the corporations wrestle with the difficult problems of investment in regimes that censor the internet, like has been done recently here. There is also a big problem around electronic surveillance as well. Of course, electronic surveillance is not really new. It goes back many decades as part of signals intelligence operations. But what I think has changed is since 9/11 in particular, states in the industrialized world immediately after 9/11 passed almost uniform legislation that created a more permissive environment for intelligence and law enforcement to collect and eavesdrop on electronic information. And this had a ripple effect in the developing world, where countries used that opportunity to do likewise. And of course now ISPs, internet service providers, are being asked to share a lot of that burden as well. And in some cases, as in China, are actually passing on sensitive information to authorities that ends up putting people in jail or worse. So electronic surveillance is a deep characteristic of the internet environment today. Most troubling of all, I would say, is this issue of an emerging arms race in cyberspace. Within the Open Net Initiative, one of our most interesting cases, I thought, was when we were monitoring for internet censorship in Kyrgyzstan and in Belarus. And we found that while the internet was mostly open in those countries, during critical periods, around elections, for example, and following elections when public demonstrations were taking place, authorities would slowly turn the tap off on the internet in terms of access to critical opposition websites, and then turn it back on after the demonstrations or election was over, thus limiting access to information in that way. And they would do so using denial of service attacks, contracting out to hackers. This is not something I should point out that's limited to countries like Belarus and Kyrgyzstan. The United States itself, for example, has recently put forth a doctrine as to how to fight and win wars in cyberspace, and has developed a whole office dedicated to cyber warfare. And that, I think, is setting off in turn a competitive dynamic among the great powers, which is leading to a militarization of this environment that should concern everybody who values what the Global Commons presents. So that's the kind of context behind which Siphon emerged. The project actually has its start as a part of the expertise that we developed at the Citizen Lab, and in particular our core researchers, especially my director of technical research, Nart Villeneuve, and a programmer that unfortunately doesn't work for me any longer. She now works for Google, Michelle Levesque. As they were doing the research, the technical investigations that we do as part of the Open Net Initiative, they of course developed a high level of expertise as to how to get around internet content filtering. And especially, they learned some of the shortcomings and weaknesses of other forms of censorship circumvention that citizens worldwide use regularly. And that's where the concept of Siphon really emerged. It was an outgrowth of the research that we've been doing as part of the Open Net Initiative on internet content filtering and circumvention. What we wanted to do with Siphon was address some of the weaknesses we saw in other forms of circumvention technologies. I should underline this, Siphon didn't invent anything that doesn't already exist. What we did instead was to take tools and methods that were being employed by people around the world and improve on them, in my mind. One way we improved upon them was by making Siphon very easy to use. We wanted this to be a tool that the average person could use on their home computers. You don't have to be a technology geek or a hacktivist to install and use Siphon. We also wanted to make it very difficult to block and hard to find. And I think we've succeeded to a great deal in doing so, although it's always impossible to completely hide what you're doing on the internet. We've tried to obscure Siphon as much as possible. And actually, I think we achieved that not technologically, but through what is one of the main characteristics of Siphon, through social means, through social networks of trust. The way Siphon works is that it's not a public proxy system that you advertise to the world. It's not a peer-to-peer network that people connect to and get around censorship that way. It works on individualized, personal, private, social networks of trust. And I'll explain more about that in a few moments. We released Siphon free, and we coded it in open source under the general public license, and there are strong reasons for that that I'll talk about in a few moments. Let me explain how Siphon works in a nutshell, and this is my simplistic, non-technical diagram of how the Siphon relationship works. At a most basic level, you have a Siphon provider, which we call a Siphon node, someone who downloads and installs Siphon on their home computer. And this is someone who lives in an uncensored location, like, say, Canada, the United States, United Kingdom, or Western Europe. And once they install Siphon on their home computer, they give the connection information to a few friends or family members that they know personally and have a trusted relationship with, who live in one of these 40 countries that censor the internet. And that connection information consists of the address for the computer, for the Siphon node, a unique username and password. And once those individuals connect to the computer, they can make requests through it, using it as a proxy. It goes and fetches the web content for them, and then delivers it back to the user. The connection takes place over an encrypted channel, HTTPS. And we did that in order to obscure Siphon, so that from the perspective of someone monitoring the traffic from above, it would look like, for all intents and purposes, like any other type of financial transaction, an eBay purchase or a bank transaction. And that is, in a nutshell, how this process works. Of course, there was a lot of coding that went into developing Siphon that isn't captured by this simplistic picture.
How does a PI find a PN?
A PI finds a PN through social networks of trust. You have to know somebody in an uncensored location.
So it's the same as making them a buddy. In concept, is making them a buddy on your buddy list and then saying, hey, would you mind if I borrowed your connection for a while to see the world as you see it?
Absolutely. And in fact, the model was presume existing buddy relationships or family relationships or collegial relationships. But as I'll talk about in a few minutes, actually one of the ways in which Siphon has evolved has betrayed the way we presumed it would work originally. So when we were using Siphon as part of the OpenNet Initiative's research prior to its release, and one of the beta testers was an Iranian who connected to a Siphon node in Western Europe, and I thought this gives a nice demonstration of how Siphon works. I'm not sure if you'll be able to hear the sound actually through my computer here.
For example, women's studies.
I'm searching for women's studies in Iran.
The page is 4 feet. Let's use Siphon.
So he goes to Siphon.
Familiar mic?
Don't reveal who it is.
Now that login page is at PN or is it Siphon Central?
It's at PN. It's at the Siphon node. As is Zubo. So he goes to Google through Siphon now and enters in women's studies.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
That thank you, guys, I must say, was for Mike and I, the the cap on the whole process. It really underscored why we were doing it and made us feel good about the project. It was so great to see someone so easily connect to information that was being denied, especially of that nature. So Siphon was released December 1st to a worldwide public audience, and we had an enormous, almost surreal press coverage, I would say, around this project. I've never been involved in a project that had such media attention. We had virtually every major media organization covering the release of Siphon, from CNN to Al Jazeera to BBC. And I think that really helped spread the word about Siphon. I think it says something about the growing awareness of internet censorship worldwide and the feelings that people have that this is a growing problem. And as Siphon has gone out there, there have been 80,000 downloads of Siphon since the release on December 1st. Yes?
Do you know how many of those copies actually got installed or how many are actively in use?
After version, I think, 1.2. It's a new feature that once people set up Siphon on their server, it pings for the IP address. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it asks one of the servers in the lab what their external IP address is, because that's what they need to tell the Siphonites. So that's been running. We've had there's 30,000 unique connections to that since we put that up.
And that's a one-time check, so we don't know how long those...
No, every time Siphon starts up.
Okay.
So it's not an exact number of things, but it indicates that it's quite busy. And, regularly every day.
Yeah, I guess the bottom line is it's well beyond what we expected. When we were thinking amongst ourselves prior to releasing this and talking about it as a research project, our highest hopes would be, maybe after a year we'll have 10,000 downloads or 10,000 nodes out there. And to have it being downloaded to this day at a rate of 500 per day is really quite something. And the feedback has been enormous. There was a forum that we set up on the Siphon site almost as an afterthought, and that forum has been bristling with activity, with people exchanging information, reporting bugs, giving us feedback, translating Siphon into local languages. There are Vietnamese, Arabic, Farsi sections of the site. We've received feedback from associations, cultural associations, people saying that, that they have found this a very useful tool. So it's been very encouraging in that respect.
Doing anything with the code itself?
That I haven't seen yet. That's an interesting question. It actually brings up a point I'm going to get to, so I'd like to get back to that in a few moments. But in terms of, who are the users of Siphon, well, some of it we've been surprised by. I think I anticipated that it would be used by ethnic diaspora communities because of the extent to which these are communities that cross censored and uncensored countries and that maintain close personal familial relationships. Those of you who know the remittance economy, for example, will understand the extent to which money that is earned in a country like the United States is sent back to family members using new information communication technology. So Siphon fit very much into the organizational paradigm of these transnational ethnic diaspora communities. I didn't quite anticipate that there would be such a response among particular communities. And also, some communities haven't been as responsive as I thought. Chinese, for example, there seems to be a bit of a roadblock there, and yet that's the one that people always point to when they talk about Siphon in the media. It might have something to do with the social network of trust aspect of Siphon. Iranians, on the other hand, Vietnamese, Burmese, are very lively users of Siphon. We've seen it used, and this was one I did anticipate. I thought that it would be used by non-governmental and advocacy organizations and human rights networks, and it certainly is. It's used among the researchers of the Open Net Initiative. They were the early beta testers of Siphon. It's also been used by journalists, and I think this was one of the consequences of journalists coming and doing the story. I'd talk to reporters, and they'd say, oh, that So I can set it up on my home computer, and when I go travel to the Middle East, I can connect to Siphon and access the internet in an unfiltered way. So it's been used a lot by journalists as well. And then this was one I didn't anticipate at all. Multinational corporations, governments, large organizations have definitely recognized a problem that requires a solution. There are other solutions that exist, but we're recognizing that Siphon may be a neat and tidy solution for this market, and that's part of what I'm talking about today. So any group, organization, or individual that needs to access information freely and securely from behind national firewalls is and can use Siphon. Now here's the important point that I always like to emphasize, because it often gets lost, especially in this media coverage that we're fortunate to receive, because the coverage at Siphon has received has unfortunately obscured a lot of other projects that are going on that are related to Siphon, complementary to it as well. And this is an area that I'm particularly interested in as a scholar, and this is why I got into the research and development projects that the Citizen Lab is involved in. And that's because I have long been interested in trying to promote projects that secure human rights online in light of the context that I talked about in the beginning of my presentation. And there are a lot of tools out there that do different things, whether it is securing email, helping to secure privacy online, helping people anonymize their web experience, as does a project called Tor that I'm sure many of you know about, that's developed over at MIT. There's PGP, there's Off the Record. MARTIS is a very prominent human rights database software system that works on a kind of peer-to-peer model to protect those individuals who collect human rights information. There are even censorship circumvention systems that are very similar to Siphon. Peacefire in particular I'd single out. So there are these there's this family of projects out there that are all complementary, that are all more or less oriented towards the same thing, and that's securing human rights online. I think the one difference with Siphon, perhaps, is that it requires only minimal computer expertise. We really designed this thing so that it would be not for hacktivists only. It would be something quite deliberately that would be adopted by the public, especially people who aren't normally accustomed to doing this sort of thing. I think we've more or less succeeded in that respect. But looking at this family of projects, I think, raises a big issue, which is, I guess, the kicker of this talk and part of the reason why I'm here, and that's, what do you do about sustaining these projects? As someone who's been involved in open source human rights software projects and research in this area for a long time, I know this is a problem that has vexed many of us. And that's projects that start out with great intentions and support end up withering because they're unable to sustain the original push behind it and the funding that helped contribute to it. So in terms of Siphon, my honest answer is that there's no guarantee that it will be sustained beyond this initial push that has happened. Or maybe not, and this is where the idea comes in that we've been exploring down here and elsewhere. So let me begin by saying, like all human rights open source software projects, Siphon depends on limited donor funding and volunteers, both of which, unfortunately, are in short supply. Siphon was funded by the Open Society Institute as part of a grant called CivicEC, which stands for Security for Civil Society. And we're very happy to have that funding and appreciate it very much, but we recognize at the same time that there's only so much you could do with that limited pool of money. And Open Society Institute is not in the business of supporting long-term research and development of this.
We should acknowledge a member of the subboard of OSI.
The subboard of OSI is here right now.
Ethan, and you can keep that in mind when you get some of the sharp questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cheating, basically. Yeah. Deflect them back toward you.
I was well aware of that. but it's a reality of donor relationships that, the funding is targeted at very specific projects. but there's not a lot of money to go around. And in fact, a lot of the projects that exist are actually in competition for this limited source of funding. The open source hacktivist community, which I've been one of the biggest proponents of, I've published about, I describe the Citizen Lab as a hacktivist lab. So I think it's wonderful, but at the same time, I understand that it can also be very fickle. And by that, I mean projects are picked up, worked upon, usually seeded with some funding, but then they dissipate or disappear. And because of the limited funding, a dynamic can be set up of self-interested competitive behavior that undermines this family as a whole. So there's a real structural problem here that needs to be addressed. And in terms of Siphon, it's just a plain reality. Without a dedicated programming and management team, which cannot be sustained without some source of funding beyond seed funding, Siphon will not likely survive beyond version 1. And so this has led us in the Siphon team to begin considering a novel approach. And that's to begin considering whether there might be a business around Siphon that could be developed through which some type of revenue stream could be directed towards underwriting and sustaining the human rights open source free version of Siphon that's proven to be valuable to the human rights community. And this is something, honestly, we've only just started to explore. And I'd be curious to hear feedback from people as to whether this is all pie in the sky or whether there is some basis for optimism. As I see it, there is a market for Siphon in four separate areas. The first is perhaps an obvious one, is one that we didn't even recognize until we started to get feedback and talk to people, and that's multinational corporations with subsidiary operations in any of the 40 countries, many of whom are newly emerging markets, will not want to access the internet through filters that are set up by governments within which they are operating, many of whom might be in collusion with their competitors. Siphon Pro, let's call it, could prove to be one important solution for that problem. There are other ways in which corporations can get around that, some of which are very powerful and already do the same things that Siphon does. But Siphon is, we would imagine, a much more flexible, easy-to-use system for that limited purpose of getting around internet censorship. There might be a market there. A bigger market, I think, would be in the area of connecting customers to businesses whose content may be blocked in any of these 40 countries. Recently, I had a conversation with a person at BBC who recognizes that BBC is filtered in a lot of countries worldwide. They have a real problem. How do we get our content to our customers? We can't set up a VPN for every single customer that we want to get content to, like maybe a multinational corporation can for its employees. We have a serious issue there. And so in that case, I think for content providers, there may be a market for the service that Siphon can provide. There are two areas that are less to do with internet censorship per se, but relate to the way in which Siphon works and the way it's been designed. Collateral markets, in other words, for Siphon. One of which is as a web intermediary. The way Siphon works, essentially, is it's positioned in between a client who's requesting information off the internet and the internet itself. Siphon goes out and fetches information, retrieves it, and sends it back to the end user. Once you look at that model in isolation, you begin to imagine a whole series of services that could be written into Siphon that might be useful for some markets. Ad insertion, ad removal, translation, and so forth. The same goes for remote access and administration. Siphon is essentially a little server that's set up on your home computer. And once you have that capacity on your computer, you can access your home computer remotely and manage your files, stream media, and so on. There are tools that do this already, but we feel not as well as Siphon does, even in its current limited state. So that's kind of the business case that we're exploring for Siphon. And I think, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm still, I'd say, cautiously hopeful that something might emerge here. But I think there is still this bigger issue about securing human rights online, the long-term agenda, how these various projects should work together, how they could be sustained beyond seed funding, beyond the initial push that gives rise to them. And here I think there's a much larger set of projects. We as a whole, all of us in this room and those who are interested in this topic need to begin seriously addressing. So I have three areas that I think are worth pursuing. One is in the area of what I would call hacktivist field building. I think this is very much what the Citizen Lab is about. It's been about that from the very beginning, and I think it's very much what the Berkman Center is about as well. And this is encouraging research and development projects that combine a normative, political, theoretical outlook, in the Citizen Lab's case, with a strong interest and a desire to promote human rights online, with computer and software engineering. And that, to me, is the basic notion of hacktivism, combining this original sense of the term hacking, the desire to understand how technologies work beneath the surface, to not accept something at face value, as shrink wrap, to explore and develop new ways of fitting pieces of technology together, but combining that original sense of hacking with a strong normative underpinning, with a desire to protect freedom of speech online and access to information. To me, that is a more than a hobby. It's a essential outlook for a liberal democratic society in the 21st century, in the hypermedia environment that we live in. It's a skill that needs to be encouraged, not just for people who are, you know, have computers are their main hobby and everything they do in life. It's a skill that needs to be cultivated among citizens worldwide. And to do that, I think we need to begin by building fields of research, by embedding this type of programmatic outlook in universities through institutions like the Citizen Lab, the Berkman Center, the OpenNet Initiative itself, which is an extremely unique collaborative project that combines political scientists, lawyers, sociologists, and computer software engineers in one project, along with advocacy organizations and rights organizations. But those of us who live in universities understand that this is a very difficult exercise. Field building will meet with a lot of resistance, both within the university bureaucracies, but also within the establishment of higher education itself. Fields have a long pedigree and tend to be protective. They're like gatekeepers around their disciplines. And new fields tend to be treated with a degree of suspicion. And so this is a long-term enterprise, but I think it very much animates all of the research that we do. I think we need to do a job of awareness raising, to reach out to the public, to educate and inform them about the threats to human rights online and about the need to, as we call it, protect the net. And this, I think, is something that's beginning to happen to an encouraging degree. I was very impressed by, for example, Amnesty International's Irrepressible Info campaign that we played a very prominent role in. In fact, just in between the break here, I got an email from the Amnesty International UK office saying they want to now begin a next phase of this project and engage the ONI further into how we could support that. I think this is very important because the balance has swung so far in the direction of concerns with security that people have forgot about basic human rights, about liberty, about free speech, about access to information, and about how the internet as a global commons is vital to all of those now. And so we need to make this a public issue, make it a worldwide issue that people support from the bottom up. And that, again, is a long-term enterprise. But in terms of the specific family of projects that exist today and that may exist in the future, like Siphon, like Tor, like the other ones that I mentioned, like MARDIS, there is a serious problem about consistent financial support. We can't all be going back to the same trough, as generous as the Open Society Institute is. And believe me, I'm the biggest applauder of the Open Society Institute. I don't say that because Ethan Zuckerman's sitting in the room.
Partly because Ethan Zuckerman's
in the room. And actually, just to sort of jump in at this point, one of the things that OSI has sort of been forced to do in this field is to actually do something of a beauty contest and to figure out what is and what's not working. There's a real recognition in the funder space that there's a need to fund human rights tools. At the same time, of the tools you listed some of the better ones. There are some less responsibly written ones that make far more aggressive claims than you're making for Siphon. And some of these tools are being funded. Some of these are being funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars. And one of the real challenges is, as a human rights funder, you look at these projects and you say, yes, it's very important. I want people in Belarus to be able to speak freely. But do we know how well these tools work? Do we know which ones work better than others? Do we know which, all of these tools have vulnerabilities? Do we know which ones are the most important? We're really interested right now in seeing how this field plays out. And it would actually probably be helpful if there were only three or four really good projects in this field rather than 30 or 40, you know, some good, some mediocre projects in this field. It's a real trick for funders right now.
Absolutely.
In this field, Ethan, just say how you're cabining this field. Is it as broad as hacktivist in Ron's definition here, or are you talking more about the Siphon-related tools?
I was talking specifically about circumvention and anti-filtering tools, and I'd probably throw anonymous publishing, which is a field that I feel like there hasn't been enough work done in, under that general heading. I would say that this ends up being true for hacktivism in general. I also think that the point that Ron is raising, which is once you build these tools, if they get adopted, there's a responsibility to sort of shepherd them out further. One of the tricks with hacktivism is that a lot of hacktivism gets accomplished by people who are programmers between projects, grad students with an axe to grind, and some of these great projects get developed, get adopted, don't get supported. And one of the scariest things that we can think about is a situation in which a human rights organization in Burma becomes highly dependent on a project that simply disappears. And this happens very, very often in the sort of NGO support space.
That's exactly what I'm wrestling with myself as a scholar who's interested in this, and also as a practitioner, as someone who's actually developed something that's being used by tens of thousands of people worldwide. So I think there is a serious issue of consistent financial support. We can't all go back to the same trough, as generous as that trough may be in the short term, and they themselves recognize, as you hear from Ethan, that there is a limited pool, and a lot of them aren't in the business of long-term support that's required to sustain projects. When you talk about software projects, you're really talking about employing people who could move to the marketplace and get paid a lot more than they could working on this type of project. So you're in a competitive environment, not just within the human rights realm, but outside of it as well. So what to do about that? Well, I think something needs to be done about the business environment. This is why I'm beginning to look to this as a possible solution, to maybe create a Siphon Pro version that businesses could pay for, those who can afford to pay for it, the innovations that are derived from it could feed back into the university to underwrite the type of research that went into Siphon in the first place and sustain Siphon as a free and open source software tool and not have to go back to the foundations over and over again. But this will require, reinvesting some of our intellectual capital back into the corporations in the way that the Berkman Center has done in shepherding this process along about having corporations wrestle within their own minds about how to draw limits around investment in companies that censor. But have them recognize the internet itself as a commons that they need to protect in the way that companies are now recognizing the environment and as a commons that needs to be protected. We need to encourage these companies again to think about the internet that way, as they did in the dot-com heydays, perhaps. And these three together, I think, they're all long-term solutions. They're not the type of things that solve the problem of Siphon in the next 3 months or 6 months. They're the type of thing that I think, the types of thing that happen over the course of a career. And that's really the level that I'm addressing this at now, is trying to build a momentum in this direction. And I think beginning with this field building exercise that we've been engaged in by continuing to raise awareness and then look for alternative innovative ways to finance projects. We might be able to tip the balance away from where it's been, unfortunately, over the last 5 years, towards closure, colonization, and militarization. So I will leave it there and hopefully engage with everyone in the room in a conversation about these topics. Fantastic. Thank you.
To ask, are there any limitations with Siphon in terms of content creation? Because I mean, certainly when you've got a situation where you've got a lot of countries, North countries, sending broadcast transfer to censored South countries, you've got sort of a one-way flow of information. I wonder, are there any limitations for people being able to actually write to websites?
It's a great question. In fact, that was one of the main design features that we wanted to build into Siphon from the beginning. We wanted to make sure that people had the ability not just to access information, but to speak freely, to be able to post on blogs, to be able to post on Wikipedia. That was no easy feat. I'm not a computer coder, but I know, listening to the people who worked on it, how difficult it was to be able to make Siphon as fast and easy to use and yet be able to have that function within it. And I'm proud to say that we achieved that. In fact, we set out with Wikipedia as kind of our model of access. We said, look, this is the type of information we want people to be able to access, and we want people to be able to contribute to. And so having Siphon enable people to make posts on Wikipedia was one of the main things that we set out to do. And it was set off really by a casual email that came my way from Jimmy Wales about concerns Wikipedia was having with people using other types of censorship circumvention systems to post onto Wikipedia and causing problems because of spam, right? And we said, well, this is a solution, because Siphon, the nodes are recognized by Wikipedia. Siphon is not an anonymizer. It doesn't obscure traffic in that respect. It allows people to get around censorship by borrowing other people's computers, essentially, and making posts to Wikipedia in that
way. John? Two questions. Are you seeing sort of like countermeasures to undermine it already? Or, I mean, has that happened? Or?
Do
you expect that?
Yes and no. We expect it, certainly. That's why, first of all, you code it in open source so that you can give it over to the people who know the most about these things and can review the code and get as many eyeballs on it as possible. Sure. And we've been very fortunate within the OpenNet Initiative to have access to some of the best and brightest, especially at Cambridge University, who've been going through and telling us, here are some of the problems and so on, which we're addressing. In terms of state countermeasures, a lot of it is a mystery because of the area that you're working in here is considered among the most secretive of state security operations. So we don't know exactly what is in the frame of mind of these people. But I can say that this site on the website was ironically filtered by Iran and China as soon as we released it. I say ironically because the way the model works is you don't want to encourage people in the censored countries to download the software. You want to have people in uncensored locations download it. There have been some funny, strange things having to do with security and intelligence organizations in this area, going back years now as part of the OpenNet Initiative research in this area. Any time that you do research that pushes back in the area of human rights, there is a risk for those involved. And not so much for the researchers in places like Toronto or Harvard, but for people in the field who are at the front edge of this, who face the most risk. And that was why, again, another feature perhaps I didn't mention with Siphon that we wanted from the outset was to have as little possible evidence of Siphon use on people's computers on the user end. So there's nothing to install, for example. And this is another shortcoming we addressed of other systems of circumvention. We wanted people to be able to download this, use it, and yet have no trace on their computer or as little as possible in case the computer is seized.
I know Kopi would like to ask a question, but may I ask one by way of follow-up to this? which is so a lawyer's concern or a security person's concern, which is let's just imagine that the next horrible thing to happen to somebody is a terror attack that involves, you know, a little bit of communication from one country to another. And it turns out that, in fact, what happened was, you know, somebody in the United States connected with somebody in another country through a Siphon node and shared that key bit of information, and it's, you know, locked up there, and something horrific happens. Mm-hmm. What then for Siphon? How do you kind of, how do you keep this, how do you think about this in the context of, okay, we're doing this for human rights activists, but it's obviously a tool for...
Yeah, it's a tough question, and it's a very serious question, and it's not just terrorism. There
whatever,
other access to any objectionable
child pornography, material, whatever it might be.
Yeah. The way I look at that is, first of all, access to information is my belief as someone who has a strong liberal outlook on life. This is a matter that's left up to individuals, and those of us who value the internet, value it because it's a place where there is that default option, or at least there should be, where everyone can choose for themselves what information they want to access. And that architecture has been slowly chopped up and winnowed away. And so what we're doing with Siphon is to try to raise the bar back up at least to that level. What people choose to do with technology is up to them. The terrorists involved in 9/11 used cell phones, rented cars, all sorts of things. So should those technologies be held accountable for what happened to them, what was how they were used? I'm sure about it. Same with extreme pornography. If Siphon enables someone to access that type of material, well, there are cameras, cell phones, and so on through which you can access the same type of material right now, including the fiber optic cable that connects us all to the webcam that's used to broadcast this. Should the manufacturers of these systems be held accountable? So once you enter into that conversation of, you know, tying the responsibility of people's actions to the technologies they use, you get into a very problematic area of responsibility. My concern is not judging or limiting how people use these systems. It's putting it out there at a base level so people can enjoy the basic human rights that I, as a Canadian, enjoy, but so many people around the world don't. And I think these are extreme examples that really are at the margins of the norm, which is most people just want to get to Wikipedia, right? And that's currently
hopefully
being
to write to Wikipedia.
I also have a follow-up to a previous answer. If anybody hacks into your company's computer, is there any kind of protection for them not to be able to guess the list of people who are using it on those sites?
Anybody hacks into the... Through Siphon, you mean? If they...
No. To your company's computer, where you keep the records of who's using Siphon.
Oh, well, we have... is there any protection for them? Yeah. If somebody hacks into our computer? Well, Mike can answer that question better than I can, but... you know, we don't, as Mike said, we don't really keep connected to this network because it's the way the model works, it's distributed, right? People download the software and go off and install it on their computers, but once that's done, apart from pinging us and having that original connection established, we don't know where who's doing what with the technology.
But individually, you know the address.
The IP address.
Well, you know where those 30,000 unique IP
We know where those, are. Exactly. So,
and they're persistent, right?
Yeah. It's a fair question. We've been working in this area for a long time, so we take security seriously in the lab itself, including the security of our system. So you just hope that the people who work for you, who understand well how these things work, are able to, you know, secure the Citizen Labs network in a way that would prevent them. Well, that's what I'm saying is, you know, developing some kind of secure system in the lab that prevents people from doing that. I'm pretty confident that's the case. In all the years that we've been doing research in this area, and we've had some of the most sensitive of information beyond just the Siphon nodes, having to do with, for example, hosting Project Margus and other servers and secure servers for Privatera organizations that work in human rights. It's something we take very seriously. So we do the best that we possibly can.
Right? So the point is, there's not ever no risk.
We're not ever any risk.
There are ways of mitigating that.
Yeah. Well, within the...
Jonathan says hand up, but you want to follow on that one?
Well, I was just going to say, there are sort of policy level
many hacks
decision. There are sort of policy level decisions that you can make beyond just we have smart geeks and we trust them. Like, for instance, if you have all these, this is a policy decision to have all these clients pinging your server, that's a risk.
Oh, I see. Sorry, I misunderstood.
You sort of opened a hole there, and then you say, well, we'll secure it well, but you've made a policy decision.
Oh, you're absolutely
and there's a
right.
policy decision whether you keep, for instance, you've got a web server somewhere where people are downloading these clients.
Yeah.
You have a decision. Do you keep those logs, or do you make it a policy that you just don't have the logs,
right.
so that regardless of what happens?
Don't people doing connecting to our server or in uncensored countries?
So you don't know that, right? There could very well be people in China who download and install this, not understanding what it's doing or wanting to try it out.
On
or,
a regular basis, that, right. That's...
Or, right.
You know, we don't really, other than people that misunderstood, those IP addresses would be in log files, which we take offline, but you know, there's certainly a period of time there afterwards.
Let's go to Jonathan and then Ethan.
Picking up on the security question, I guess you'd want to make sure that somebody is volunteering his or her home computer to be a PN, a node, ought to never have the slightest worry that that could expose the computer itself to some kind of compromise. I think trying to bundle it as part of a business plan with VNC-like functionality, hey, thanks to this Siphon module, you can access all your files from far away, might worry people, because then it means that others, ostensibly just using VPN as a proxy, could access all your files. So it seems sensible to me to keep it as only a hopping-off point that is otherwise completely isolated from the specific characteristics of the node. But this gets back to your question about business plan, and I had two thoughts on that. One was, I think it would be very helpful if people in these corners could come up with a legal analysis of your liability or lack thereof for running a PN that ends up doing bad things. And my own noodling about this is that your liability is probably zero, that you're about in the position of a regular internet service provider. But I don't know of anybody that's actually written a paper that says that and cites the right cases. And that can be very helpful so that people don't think of this as kind of gray market, dirty stuff.
Yeah, that would be very helpful, actually, because I've had those type of questions.
Yes.
And the only response we've had up until now has been putting a strong caveat, you know, on the frequently asked questions, saying, look, you know, this is a risky proposition.
Your mileage may vary,
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not what people want to hear. So it'd be interesting to figure out
if there was something stronger that could be said.
Exactly. And the same questions apply when you have something like phone or other sharing facilities at the physical layer.
Interesting.
The second thought I had was, you have a lot of real estate on the landing page of the PN that the PI sees that right now is fallow. It's just a blank page with the blue bar that says, where would you like to go today?
Right.
And it might be interesting to go to the usual suspect places that are blocked. BBC, for example, which is the most activist among the sites that are blocked, and cut a deal with BBC where it importunes the people who can get to BBC to download from BBC or linked from there a BBC-branded version of Siphon that would then allow their friends to see BBC and, alternately, any other sites they want to. But you could imagine building a version of Siphon for them that has BBC and the BBC homepage as kind of the first landing spot.
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion. In fact, based on previous discussions we had, we were you know, zeroing in that sort of area, but not quite as artfully as.
And if you got a couple to sign on, it might shame the rest.
Yeah.
Where's the New York Times? Right. Where's the Wall Street Journal?
Right.
They all want to offer
shame
their
index.
Brands.
Yeah. That's right.
Very good suggestion. Thanks for that.
Well, we should. Let's before anything, just a note to follow up with our clinical guys, because I know Phil. Right now, this is actually conflicting with the first clinical meeting of the year.
Okay.
But when they come back, let's make sure we connect with Phil and Matt on the first one. That would be good. Assignment.
I should say, by the way, that I failed to mention that the law clinic was an excellent resource for us.
I'm glad.
In putting together the GPL and, you know, licensing issues around all of this that we've been struggling with.
This is an infomercial for the Berkman Center Clinical Program. One of the students actually
awesome
did this work.
Yeah.
So,
awesome.
And secondly, it's like the Netscape model or the Mozilla model in a way that Jonathan suggested, which is something that doesn't seem like it necessarily ought to be revenue generating, but when you have people, you know, downloading this thing, you have, you know, an aggregation, basically.
Right, yeah. So it's good.
Ethan, and then maybe one more.
Pair of questions, which you are welcome to duck, hand to Michael, or duck altogether.
Okay.
Question one,
back to you.
which is sort of the node discovery question.
Right.
Generally, I do a lot of work with people in highly censored countries. What they want to know is, how do I access content?
Right.
And telling them, find someone who can run Siphon and then do it, is a less satisfactory answer in many cases than use Tor.
Right.
And so use Tor is the answer that I end up giving.
Right.
A lot of people are going to hear about Siphon, are going to be in a censored nation, are going to attempt to go to the site, and once they figure it out, are going to realize that unless they already have that pre-existing personal contact and someone who's willing to set up a server, send them an IP, and then keep them in touch with any changes to that IP every time their machine reboots.
Yeah. Mm.
How are you guys planning on getting around those issues? So for someone who doesn't immediately have a contact, you know, a family member that they're in touch with weekly, who in the weekly phone call can give them the current IP address, how do we reach those second and third order users?
It's an excellent question, and we thought about it long and hard, but let me answer it this way, a bit of a backtrack. When we set out to do Siphon, we didn't set out to create something that would be the solution once and for all. We wanted to create something that would at least improve upon existing methods of circumvention. Primarily, the way in which people get around censorship now is by connecting to insecure open public proxies. And this is a way that when we were doing research on the anonymizer system in Iran, this is one of the earlier efforts of the Open Net Initiative. For those of you who don't know, the International Broadcasting Bureau set up a circumvention system with a company called Anonymizer, targeted at Iranian citizens. And they offered it as a secure way to get around internet censorship, much like Siphon. And the way they set it up was by broadcasting the connection information through Voice of America and other means to Iranian citizens, who then connected to these proxy computers that were publicly known because they were broadcast, so authorities could easily block them. Once they connected to them, as we did through the Open Net Initiative, we found that the filters were set up with porn filters of their own. And this was quite funny, and this was what most of the attention was about, these crude porn filters that were put on the anonymizer because they were paid for by taxpayer money. So, for example, georgewbush.com was inaccessible because of the keyword Bush. USembassy.state.gov was inaccessible because of that. What was much more serious, though, was that the circumvention system was entirely insecure, so that the Iranian authorities were able to monitor everything that was going on. I thought that was completely irresponsible. I was completely aghast by this, and in fact, that was what prompted the whole setting off of the Siphon development project. So we tried to do things in a way that just improved marginally over existing systems. Anonymizer being one of them, the case of Iran. Open public proxies, as Chinese tend to use, being another. So we don't try and solve everything. There are limitations then with Siphon. You have to know somebody in a uncensored country. Not everyone will know somebody. People will search for nodes. That's a difficult issue. But that said, there are extensive transnational networks among ethnic communities that exist. We know that simply by the uptake of Siphon, which has been enormous. And one of the surprising things about the Siphon propagation model that we didn't expect was on the forum, communities have been established among these associations that are kind of acting as peer relationships or trusted proxies themselves for Siphon nodes. I'll give you one example. There's a guy on the forum who, when Siphon was released, said, "I'm such a supporter of free speech, I'm going to set up a Siphon node and publicize the connection information. Anybody who wants to use it, come connect to it." So other people on the forum said, "Don't do it, that's stupid, because the government will block your Siphon node." So he said, "Okay, then, here's my email address. Send me an email if you want a Siphon connection." Hundreds of people emailed him. He had certain qualifications. "I'm going to watch everything that you surf," which you can do with Siphon. It's a protection mechanism built into it. Siphon node administrators have log files of everything that the Siphon people visit. That's why it's not an anonymous. He said, if you try to visit porn or something I find objectionable, I'm going to cut you off. So this one guy is acting as a node for people in Iran and China who want to use his Siphon node for reasons that he makes plain he thinks are fine. Other people are sharing Siphon nodes in similar ways. So there's been this kind of trusted social network emerging among Siphon node administrators through community associations. It may take some time. You may hear a lot of frustrated people, as we have. I get a lot of emails from Iranians and Vietnamese saying, I can't get Siphon, how do we do this? You know, but I think over time that will change. One other thing, in a version that we're working on now, we're going to build into the Siphon node part of the equation the same sort of social network trust model as exists between Siphon nodes and Siphon clients, a kind of peerage among Siphon nodes where you could assign levels of trust so that if I have a Siphon node and you have a Siphon node and my computer goes down, I could pass off some of my clients to you, and my clients could also assign a level of trust to say, for example, I never want that to happen, right? Other people who are in a less risky situation may say, well, all I care about is being able to access BBC, so I have less concerns with security. I don't mind being passed off to Ron's friend. So that's another way to address that problem. So I guess the short answer is, it is a problem. It's one we're aware of, but we never intended to create a magic bullet. We're just trying to do some small things better than what previously existed.
Since we're getting close to overtime, I might just finish with Ethan's and then go to Mathieu. Is that, or Jonathan, do you?
It's fine.
Is that okay? And then maybe we'll follow up with Ethan. Ethan, do you have a second half to that question?
I do, but it's highly technical. And why don't we just pass on to...
Okay. I have a very small question. In terms of consistent funding, but so have you gotten any reactions from governments? And do you think, I mean, like the U.S. has an internet task force that they set up a year ago, I think. And do you think they might be interested in supporting this? And if you haven't gotten feedback, what would you expect their reaction?
It's an excellent question. And again, it's one of those ones that we've wrestled with. I'm aware of this fund. This is a U.S. government fund. For us, it's a big dilemma. It's one that we've struggled with in the Citizen Lab for many years because we've been approached many times by government agencies who share strategic interests in this area, maybe not in a universal way that we do. Mm-hmm. They are selectively targeting particular countries that are happen to be adversaries. For us, it would be a big problem to accept money from the U.S. government for this type of research. It would undermine the neutrality and the extent to which we've established some credibility within the Citizen Lab among the human rights community, especially among people in countries where the United States is seen, if not as a major threat, as being allied to the governments that torture them, throw them in jail, and so on. We just cannot do that.
What about Canada?
Even there, it's not a good thing, right? There are organizations that launder money creatively that maybe you could approach, but the bottom line is we're an independent academic research and development organization. Taking money from the Open Society Institute's okay, from MacArthur Foundation, from Ford Foundation, but from the CIA, Rasta don't work with no CIA.
That sounds like the perfect note.